taking down the fence was a big goal. I think the people in Quebec felt very offended that these heads of state would come in and build a fence in their city and tell them that they couldn't have access to this area of their city so that they could have these supposedly open, transparent, and democratic meetings. And I think the fence was really symbolic of all that's wrong with this agreement in the first place. So another thing that happened is the fence came down several times during the weekend. People did not rush in and storm the summit as the corporate media was trying to make people believe.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Thursday, May 4th, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this half-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll hear from three Santa Cruz activists on their experiences at last month's demonstrations in Quebec City against the FTAA. And later, Freak Radio's Max Boykoff speaks with Aaron Moore of Students for Economic Justice on the police infiltration of that organization. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now headlines for the week ending Thursday, May 4th, 2001. On Friday, April 27th, 45-year-old Ulla Roeder, a Danish anti-nuclear activist, was arrested inside Britain's Faslane naval base after she swam past guards and spray-painted the word useless on the hull of a Trident submarine. Roeder, who called the stunt easy, was reportedly trying to pull anti-radar tiles off the submarine when she was spotted. She is believed to have swum for several hours to get inside the security zone around the base. Britain's Navy launched an investigation to determine how she avoided security. Zapatista leaders are rejecting an indigenous rights bill passed Saturday, April 28th, at the Mexican Congress. The bill was passed earlier last week by the Senate, with modifications added by leaders of President Fox's National Action Party. Zapatista leaders say those changes would make it impossible for indigenous groups spread out across several states in Mexico to maintain unified recognition of their people. The modified version of the law also limits the legal control Indians have over their lands. Several activists from Greenpeace protested outside the National Defense University on Monday, May 1st, where President Bush was promoting a missile defense shield. In his speech Monday, Bush outlined his plan to expand the land-based missile defense shield to include ships, aircraft, and even satellites in a multi-tiered system. He made no mention of how much the proposal would cost or how it would work. According to a senior administration official, the president spent much of the weekend calling leaders of several major European allies to discuss the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. While Bush has announced proposed reductions in the number of nuclear weapons, mainly from stock that is outdated and useless, he is proposing an increase in the budget of $5.3 billion for the design, development, and production of nuclear weapons. In a statement issued Sunday, Greenpeace said although Bush would like the American public to believe that his defense plan is designed to protect the country from so-called rogue countries such as Iran and Iraq, the United States is the true rogue country in trying to reignite a nuclear arms race. Meanwhile, activists are making plans for a massive, nonviolent security zone occupation at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California on May 19th to oppose what they see as the militarization of space. And finally, May 1st, known internationally as May Day, is the day of celebration that recognizes the power and solidarity of workers worldwide. The origins of the day goes back to the 1700s, when May 1st was a pagan day to celebrate the start of the spring season, and later it commemorated the Chicago Haymarket Square Massacre of 1886, where four policemen were killed when a bomb exploded during a labor strike, calling for an 8-hour day. Police violence at the rally resulted in 8 workers' deaths. Later, four anarchists, Albert Parsons, August Spies, George Engel, and Adolf Fischer, were executed on charges of conspiracy. This year, massive protests on May Day were met by police repression around the globe. In London, 91 people were arrested after thousands marched in the streets. 20,000 protesters marched for workers' rights at Daewoo Motors in Korea. In New Zealand, demonstrators forced the closure of offices in Wellington, while in Long Beach, California, a peaceful march of about 150 people ended in chaos when police in riot gear surrounded the marchers and opened fire with rubber bullets and arrested nearly everyone present. For more info on the May Day demonstrations on the World Wide Web, please visit the Independent Media Center at www.indiemedia.org. On Friday, April 20th, the Summit of the Americas began in Quebec City, Canada, as the heads of state from 34 Western Hemisphere nations met with their corporate allies to create the largest privatized zone on the planet by the year 2003. Known as the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the deal would significantly increase the power of corporations to constrain governments from setting standards for public health and safety, to safeguard their workers, and to ensure that corporations do not pollute the communities in which they operate. Effectively, these rules would paralyze government's public interest policymaking and enhance corporate control at the expense of citizens throughout the Americas. An estimated 40,000 protesters descended upon the streets of Quebec City as solidarity rallies drew thousands more around the hemisphere. Many activists from Santa Cruz were among those who made it across tight border security. Aaron is a young man who voiced his opinions in the streets of Quebec. Here, he explains his reasons for attending the demonstrations and describes the similarities of NAFTA and the FTAA.
There is no voice from the outside. It's only these multinational corporations that are coming together, and they're not listening to any outside voice. It's very apparent with a four-mile fence that they set up around the city that they don't want any outside voice. It's basically a total undemocratic system. We have an example of that with the MTBE here in California, where basically our governor made a slow phase out of the major suppliers of that in Canada. It said this goes against the Chapter 11 in NAFTA, where they decided to sue the United States of America for $1 billion because we decided that it isn't good because the MTBE is leaking into our water and it's causing health effects in people, and they're saying it goes against the free trade agreement. So they're suing us, and now they want to put it back in.
Protest organizers, learning from past mobilizations, realized that people opposed to the FTAA were coming from a diverse and varied background, and organized the day's events into three different zones.
To recognize everybody's different plans and different types of actions that they wanted to take, they would have a green zone set up where it was just basically a marching zone. It wouldn't be in a tent area at all. And then there would be a yellow zone, which would be kind of the civil disobedience. You were acknowledging that you were risking arrest in that zone. And a red zone, which was high-intensity, diverse tactics area. The march took off into two different directions. One was kind of a civil disobedience area. They had planned that they were going to do a 400-person lockdown in a key intersection that would block delegates from coming in. And then there would be the Clack March, which is the anti-capitalist march, which would be the kind of reddish yellow area. And it was said at the spokes council meeting the night before that due to most likely infiltrators in that meeting, that none of the red zone activities would be talked about. It was up to each affinity group, but most likely that the red activity would be breaking off from the yellow red march, and it'd be up to, there was no apparent red zone plan, but it'd be up to each affinity group of what to do from that point.
Despite an $80 million security plan involving 6,500 military and police from several agencies, the meeting had to be delayed for nearly 2 hours after thousands of activists participated in tearing down a 300-foot section of the 10-foot-high fence, which was erected around a 2-mile stretch of downtown Quebec City.
Taking down the fence was a big goal. I think the people in Quebec felt very offended that these heads of state would come in and build a fence in their city and tell them that they couldn't have access to this area of their city so that they could have these supposedly open, transparent, and democratic meetings. And I think the fence was really symbolic of all that's wrong with this agreement in the first place. So another thing that happened is the fence came down several times during the weekend. People did not rush in and storm the summit as the corporate media was trying to make people believe.
Lisa was in Quebec working as an independent journalist. Here, she describes how the police responded to the protesters after the fence came down.
As soon as the police came out to defend that line, people immediately became very hostile towards the police. Like they don't put up with as much from their police as we do here in this country, I think. And what I mean by that was immediately they started throwing things over the fence at the police, and the police kind of stood there, and they were getting hit with, you know, paint and rocks and sticks. But then once they decided to be aggressive and use force, it was like they couldn't stop. They just kept tear gassing. And they're only supposed to shoot it up in the air, and they were shooting it directly at people. And then they brought out the water cannons, and then they, you know, used a different kind of tear gas. So it was interesting that there wasn't as much direct physical violence on behalf of the police aside from the gassing. But to me, it wasn't as out there as it was in protests that had been in the U.S.,
While police brutality in Quebec may not have been as much brute force, the injured would tell a different story, if they could. 28-year-old Eric Leferrier will never speak again. Two rubber bullets fired by Quebec police severed a nerve in his left arm and crushed his larynx. He has undergone a tracheotomy and awaits further surgery. One young man was in critical condition after being shot in the throat with a plastic bullet, while another activist suffered eye injuries when he was struck in the face by shrapnel from an exploding tear gas canister. Macon is a young Santa Cruz resident who attended the protests. She describes the tactics of the Quebec police.
I saw them shoot someone directly in the hip with a tear gas canister, which are about 900 degrees. And then I saw a lot of people getting shot with plastic bullets. They use plastic and not rubber this time, which I saw some of them. They're huge.
Mass media coverage of the protests was few, and the reports that did surface were largely biased and inaccurate. This, according to Lisa, is due to the Quebec Police Department's indiscriminate use of tear gas.
So it got to the point where it was seeping into, where they were afraid it would seep into the corporate media center, so they did a lockdown, and it drove the media people crazy because they wanted to get out to report on the story, and they couldn't get out. And what was interesting is the media people that were already outside wanted to get back in because they were getting gassed, and they wouldn't open the doors and let those people in. So the next day, a lot of corporate media people were out on the streets, and Chrétien did a press conference, and hardly anybody showed up because everybody was out on the streets because they wanted to know what was going on out there. And there was also a media advisory that went out saying, hey, we might need to lock this place down with very short notice. It's up to you if you want to stay or go. Some people think a lot of delegates actually left at that point. So the media people didn't want to get stuck inside, so they went outside, and then they did start reporting on the protest.
While the meeting wasn't stopped, in fact, the FTAA was ratified by 33 of the 34 leaders, activists are generally in agreement that these protests were largely successful and that the anti-globalization movement continues to grow.
It was kind of apparent that we wouldn't be shutting down the meetings from the start. I mean, there was 6,000 armed police officers that were working that day. They were totally prepared, and we weren't going to be able to shut it down. But that is one of the successful things, is it seems like the movement together is still building, and people are still going to these events for their first time. And the movement is, from what I've seen, is there's, you know, a more militant strategy out there, and people have, you know, decided no longer to sit down and block intersections, but to take more militant strategies.
I think actually one of the most successful moments for me wasn't even up at the front lines. It was one of the celebrations we had after the second day was under the bridge where they had been serving the free food. There was this amazing, amazing scene of this huge bonfire, and everyone was dancing around it, and everyone had rocks and sticks in their hands, and they were just banging on anything they could to make this amazing beat that I can't even describe how exhilarating it was. Like, all of the subcultures were melting together, and everybody was there, and food was free, and it was just this amazing vibe, and I think we were all just in awe of ourselves and our strength. And to me, it was just showing the world that can come up, you know, this world where everyone's just free and really feeling strong and empowered.
I think it's really important that people educate themselves about these issues. People need to start paying attention to independent media. Don't trust what the corporate media tells you about these protests. I think a key is going to be education, and I see it happening, because even the most closed-minded American, or really anybody, has to eventually go, well, why do people keep doing this? You know, they can only call us middle-class white kids with nothing better to do for so long before people are going to see through that. And I think education, talking about it, and I think that's what it takes, is people going and experiencing this firsthand and seeing the solidarity and realizing that there is another way, that we can do this a different way.
Controlled by
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're listening to the Weekly Freak Show on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM. Please stay tuned for contact information at the end of this half-hour broadcast. That was Anti-Flag with this week's spotlight sound, Daddy Warbucks, from their latest release titled Underground Network, available on Fat Wreck Chords. Last month, Michigan State University officials confirmed that an undercover officer posed as a student to infiltrate a campus activist group. On Friday, April 27th, the Lansing, Michigan chapter of the ACLU filed a request for documentation on the extent of the surveillance under the Freedom of Information Act and may take legal action soon. Aaron Moore is with Students for Economic Justice and has been active in the movement against sweatshops that make clothing for universities in the U.S. He spoke with Freak Radio's Max Boykoff about the infiltration of the group he works with, the effects it has had on their campus organizing, and the larger movement to stop sweatshop abuses.
The infiltration started in February of 2000, which was at the end of the school year last year, and lasted for a good bit of like 5-6 months, and all throughout the summer as well. The argument that the police chief first posed to us why the infiltration was justified were three cases. The first being the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle in November, and a few members of the MSU community, not necessarily affiliated with Students for Economic Justice or United Students Against Sweatshops, which is the national name for our organization, was affiliated with, and so some of those members got arrested for civil disobedience, minor charges, which I think two people got arrested for a couple hours at a time. The second being a protest on Madison, Wisconsin's campus, University of Wisconsin, by a sweatshop group, which broke out between a skirmish when a sit-in was posed and the police tried to move those students. And a skirmish began. Nobody was arrested, but the police were dragging students out of the building and arresting students. And then the third being Wolfenson coming to campus is really interesting. It was interesting because the administration posed to the student body that this was a major concern and that the university was getting letters from concerned members of the community and families because they wanted the graduation to go smoothly and they didn't want protesters to ruin their special day for them. But if you look at the facts, the announcement when James Wolfenson was coming to campus happened several months after the infiltration began.
I see.
So to use this as an excuse for the infiltration is completely unjustified. So you have three things left, and one I did not mention, which is the bombing of a biotech laboratory in the agriculture building in the summer of 1999, which was claimed by the Earth Liberation Front, which is a very loosely affiliated organization with no head and no affiliation with anybody in our organization. The investigation is actually ongoing to try to link some of the members of our organization to this group, and it's completely unjustified, unbased, and unreasonable. And hopefully that search will go on longer. What I'd like to find interesting is that the administration actually lied to our organization about 4 weeks ago, a year after this event happened, when we had a meeting, a private meeting with McPherson and the administration, along with the Students for Economic Justice. And Peter McPherson, being the president of MSU, when asked if an undercover officer was placed in our organization, he denied it and laughed in our faces. And this was 4 weeks ago. And just then, a week later, this story broke. The police officer was spotted at a rally where Bill Clinton actually came to our campus and spoke. And there was a Free Leonard Peltier rally outside, and it is that rally where Jaime Gonzalez, the undercover cop / education studies junior, she was spotted in uniform. So quite interesting.
Why was James Wolfenson selected to speak at the commencement ceremony?
James Wolfenson happens to be kind of close to our president McPherson at Michigan State University. If you take a look at the history of McPherson, he started his illustrious career, might I say, first off, working for the Internal Revenue Service. And then from there, going on to the White House. Then from there, we start his international financing career, starting with the Overseas Private Investment Corporation from 81 to 87. And then from there, moving on to the United States Agency for International Development. Now, if anyone has any historical background on USAID, they know all the shady dealings of the USAID and Alliance for Progress, starting with the Kennedy administration during the 60s, completely destroying economies there. And then McPherson moving on from the Agency of International Development to the Deputy Secretary of Treasury Department of the United States under Reagan and then Bush. From there, moving on to Bank of America, specializing in global debt restructuring. So we see these international ties. And we see his connections, especially with Sam Brown, who is the president or presiding head officer of the Fair Labor Association, which is a major board to monitor sweatshop abuses, which is currently boarded by corporations, corporate dominated. And so we see political motivation behind our campaign on campus to join the Workers' Rights Consortium, which is an independent monitoring group, and for us to drop off the FLA. With consistent actions protesting the World Bank and the president speaking on campus. And so we see these events as highly motivated, highly politicized, and there's direct correlation between the infiltration and our organization trying to push off the FLA and his ties to the international community. The Fair Labor Association, it was actually started, I think, in 1994 by the Clinton administration, and it has... I think it has about 6 or 7 seats dedicated to corporate chairs, and then it has about 4 or 5 human rights organizations, and then the rest is, I think there's one person who represents the university community. This organization has basically scheduled visits to sweatshops around the globe, and they use PricewaterhouseCoopers as their monitoring board, which is another privately funded corporation. And we see inconsistencies in this, in that how can a corporation be responsible for monitoring its own factories, or monitoring the factories which it subcontracts, in most cases. Herein lies the campaign of student sweatshop activists nationwide to join the Workers' Rights Consortium, an organization born from United Students Against Sweatshops a few years back that's boarded with human rights activists, professors, university officials, that does unscheduled searches of sweatshops where the universities that sign on to the WRC, like where their factories are located. And with the help of Nike, especially on Michigan State's campus and University of Michigan's campus, disclosing where those factories are located, we can use that information to go search out the sweatshops.
What is the mood? What is the current mood of the organization? And has it stymied any of the efforts that you guys have been making for economic justice and this anti-sweatshop labor movement?
I think it's been really good because it's made the university recognize us, because McPherson actually okayed the infiltration. He was told about it a week after it occurred. Prior to it happening, the vice president of Michigan State was consulted, and the vice president okayed it, and the president was informed a week later. This is the information that police chief Bruce Benson gave us, so this is all highly, I mean, who knows about this information? What has happened is there's been a solidarity in the activist community and in classrooms where people are talking about this. This is bringing out a dialogue, and this has gotten even more publicity about our group and about our cause than ever before. It's too bad it happened towards the end of the year, so usually what happens is people go away from the summer, travel abroad, go to some beach resort, and then forget about, you know, real life, and then come back to school and off in a little bubble for the rest of the time, but... It has given us leverage. I actually have a personal meeting with McPherson, him and I, in his office next week. And I doubt that would have happened ever had this event not occurred.
Has he come out publicly and talked since denying the allegations of the undercover police officer in your organization? Has he come out publicly and made any comments since then?
I believe in one state news article he made a statement. The police chief came to the student governing board of Michigan State, and it was an open meeting. And so there was a question and answer period for the police chief. And at that presentation, McPherson issued a public statement, which basically rationalized in everyone's head why the infiltration began and how it was justified and why it didn't stifle public debate, basically taking a very nonchalant look at it and not taking it as a big deal. But he is concerned, and he did appoint. What's interesting is that there's a three-person panel that we have had open discourse about setting policies for future infiltration. We would like this board to say that there should never, ever be another infiltration again. During the civil rights movement and anti-war protest here at Michigan State during the 1960s, there is something called the Red Squad, which is where the FBI and local police were gathering files and keeping them on political activists and sending them to the FBI, to nationwide databases, and basically doing some very unconstitutional things, while at the same time the Michigan State Police Department was training Vietnamese insurgents to send back to Vietnam to fight against the Viet Cong. And so a lot of old activists in the community are seeing a lot of ties to what happened back in the 1960s nowadays with this anti-globalization, anti-neoliberalist attitude on campus. They've seen a very close correlation between the two events and how things haven't changed, and how we have a commitment to open dialogue and to the open air discussion of ideas and thought and progress on this campus.
Has this served to increase enrollment in these student activist groups, or has it served to discourage people, and has it been prohibitive of people perhaps getting an FBI file opened up in their name? Maybe it's encouraging people, showing them that they have the potential to be effective, like it seems as though you guys have been. Why they would put a police officer on the undercover payroll to go into your group. But could you speak to that? Is there a rallying cry now, or are there people that are shying away?
Well, I'll begin by upstating Cornel West, who is an esteemed speaker from Harvard, I do believe. When asked with the question of, you know, how should we feel about this, about the police infiltration, he basically said it's the sign that your group is a success, and that you're succeeding, and that you're working, and that you're seen as a viable threat. So we take this, and we're going to use it as a publicity to expand upon our movement and gain community support, and to use this to further educate the community on our cause. As far as membership enrollment at the end of the year, it happened so close to the end that we didn't see an influx of people coming to our meetings. But what I think it is going to, I think what it did was, since our group, especially being linked, there was one article in the State News which labeled campus organization linked to arson charges. Like, these types of blatant charges linking us to arson on campus, I think it really divides, like, campus opinion. But I think what happens is that it's a lot of them and us when there's a lot of publicity in the organization. So a lot of people are going to be like, well, can I join this? There's so much momentum that this group has anyways. Is there any room for me as an individual, as a student who wants to come and add something to this? And it's our job as an organization to make sure that those people that, you know, might feel discluded in the movement because there's so much happening without them, that we do need their support and that they're just as important as any one of us in the organization.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on more than 15 non-commercial, micro-powered, community, and web-based radio stations, including WHUS 91.7 FM from the UConn campus in Storrs, Connecticut. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all 24 hours a day, please visit our website for instructions on how to hear our live stream at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to FRSC@microradio.net. That's FRSC@microradio.net, or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project and San Francisco Independent Media Center for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. Recorded portions provided by Old Lady Scar Arms. For Max Boykoff and all the folks here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.